SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
City of Pasadena's Director of Public Health and Chief Health Officer.
And the way diseases like COVID function, the epidemiology crosses borders. It crosses, you know, and it's international and it does not respect our jurisdictional lines. So we have to coordinate our efforts in order to be effective.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, Dr. Ying Ying Go. Now, here's your host, Howard Wolf.
The pandemic has been the genesis of many, many stories. We have heard countless stories about COVID patients and those we have lost. We have heard stories about the doctors and nurses on the front lines of healthcare, as well as those who have supported them. We've heard stories about the scientists who miraculously created vaccines in record time. And we have heard stories of many of the rest of us whose lives have been impacted in so many other ways by the pandemic. We rarely hear stories, however, about public health officials whose job it is to battle health crises like the pandemic on the ground. Sure, we heard much about Dr. Fauci and his tireless work at the national level, but we heard very, very little about the stalwart men and women who protect our health at the city and county levels on a daily basis. Today's guest on Stanford Pathfinders is one of these local health officials. Dr. Ying Ying Go has 2 degrees from Stanford, an undergraduate degree in 1994, and an MD in 2002. She is now the City of Pasadena's Director of Public Health and Chief Health Officer for that municipality. And she has stories to tell. Ying, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Howard. It's so nice to be here.
All right, so I always like to start the show with the same question of all Stanford alums, and that is, what is your Stanford origin story? Why Stanford?
So, Howard, I grew up in the heartland in Toledo, Ohio, and I had actually never stepped foot on the continental U.S. west of the Mississippi until the day I landed in San Jose at what was then a small airport for freshman orientation. And so I think at my school, the first person to ever go to Stanford was a young woman in the class ahead of me. So it was not well known, particularly well known to Ohio high school students. But, you know, as I did my research and I learned about Stanford, I really had the sense that it was a non-traditional place. I think that's what drew me to it, that it was very unconstrained and just offered, you know, me a lot of opportunity. And as a young person, really, what more could you want?
I get it. And I had the exact same experience. So you didn't just choose Stanford once. You ended up choosing Stanford twice because you not only went there as an undergraduate, but you went there for medical school. So why Stanford Medical School? Why not try something else? Get a different flavor at Baskin and Robbins.
Yeah. So after graduation, I left California for 3 years. I worked in Princeton and in New York City, which was transformative and an amazing experience that I loved. But I think what drew me back to Stanford for medical school was that same sense of what Stanford could offer educationally. And the fact that it really was structured to encourage interdisciplinary learning, innovation, creativity, and some of the ways that it really did pan out to be that way for me was that I was able to earn, for example, tuition remission by doing research with Professor Alan Enthoven's group on healthcare insurance at the business school. and that I could, you know, work as a teaching assistant. I participated in a cross-disciplinary graduate program called the Asia Pacific Scholars, where I was able to engage with law students and political science students looking at domestic and foreign policy, and even visited Washington, D.C. with that group and dialogued with Dianne Feinstein and Justice Kennedy. And so these are the kinds of opportunities that even as a medical student, as a professional student, I was able to explore and take advantage of at Stanford, which, you know, at the risk of sounding like a commercial for our beloved university, really, truly, I don't think would have been available to me at other medical schools, and were really instrumental in my development as a worldly physician leader, someone who's compassionate and really well-rounded, that, you know, really led to my ability to function professionally in the way that I have since then.
So when we talk about the interdisciplinary nature of Stanford, it's not just something in a brochure. You lived it on a daily basis as a medical student. I love that story. So you became a pediatrician, and then you decided to leave that work, leave that clinical structure, that clinical field, and become a public health professional. Talk to us a little bit about that transition, because that must have been a difficult decision to make.
Well, so I would argue actually that pediatrics is an excellent entree into public health, because if you think about the work of a pediatrician caring for sick children and well children, it's really about health promotion, prevention, a focus of protecting kids through immunization with vaccinations, protecting them from infectious diseases, and a lot of education, mainly of parents, but also young people. And, this is the heart of what public health is. And so it actually prepared me quite well. In addition, I think advocacy for children is an essential part of supporting their health, both mental and physical health. And that as pediatricians, we are trained to do that advocacy. And often that comes in the form of policy advocacy.
So I get that. And thank you for correcting me. That's a very, very good point that you just made. But you left the clinical world and you went into the public health world.
Yeah. I think looking back, I was pretty much on track already. My undergraduate degree was in public policy and was able to continue that work. And after my clinical training at Boston Children's Hospital in clinical pediatrics, was able to pursue a fellowship looking at community-based research and how to make change, positive change for communities and improve health in that way. And so there were a lot of options for me in my training to really prepare me to improve population health and make a difference on a much broader level, in addition to really the rewarding work of working with people one-on-one, which I still get to do as a health officer. We manage individual infectious disease cases, whether it's tuberculosis or STDs. We do help people one-on-one, but really looking at preventing a broader spread of infectious diseases.
All right. As I said in the introduction, you are the City of Pasadena's Director of Public Health, and you have an organization of a little bit over 100 people, right?
That's correct.
Okay. How prepared were you for the pandemic? I mean, I can't even imagine what it felt like to be in your shoes when this hit in March of 2020.
So, I think what people don't realize is that in public health, we are constantly preparing for public health emergencies. Since 9/11, we've had a small amount of funding, but consistent funding that for a department like mine, which is a mid-sized health department in California, at least 40% of county jurisdictions in California have a smaller population than our city. And so we've had, one or two staff, and we supplement that with other grants to have a small program that's our emergency preparedness program. And a lot of the exercises that we do annually include scenarios such as for a flu pandemic or a bioterrorist attack like an anthrax release. And so we run exercises at the city, county, state, and national levels. And we you know, had a store, for example, of PPE from the actual H1N1 pandemic that happened. And so it's not unusual. What we weren't prepared for was, with decades of underinvestment in our public health infrastructure, the biggest pandemic, you know, in 100 years. And so that was very challenging. One, you know, some of the structures, to give you an idea of how we are prepared, we train in the National Incident Management System, which is an all-hazard system in which I'm the incident commander. And so we have a response structure and framework. We had, we exercise large-scale vaccine dispensing. MPODs are called medical points of dispensing, which we had to stand up this time around, where we could deliver 2,000 shots a day. And the challenging part, of course, was having the workforce to do this and training people real time, volunteers, city staff, other staff that, you know, new hires, to really be able to do this safely and efficiently.
There are many unsung heroes in the story of this pandemic, and I have to believe that health officers are right at the top of that list. So let's talk about jurisdictional matters, right? So up here where Stanford is located, the county rules and cities follow. How does it work in Pasadena? I mean, you're a big city. How does it work?
So what's interesting is that our health department has been around for 129 years, and the county health department has been around for 15. So The way we're structured as far as health officer authorities in California is by local jurisdiction. There are three cities, Berkeley, Pasadena, and Long Beach, and we pre-existed the county. Now, the county is much larger than we are, so we work together. And the way diseases like COVID function, the epidemiology crosses borders. It crosses, you know, and it's international, and it does not respect our jurisdictional lines. So we have to coordinate our efforts in order to be effective.
So I'm almost afraid to ask this next question. It has to do with challenges. And you faced myriad challenges as a part of this pandemic. You already mentioned some. What would you say were the two or three biggest challenges you faced in responding?
So when I talk about the chronic underinvestment in the public health infrastructure, it really showed in our pandemic response. In the beginning, it was very difficult in lacking the adequate testing resource. And of course, we all know the direct harm of not having enough PPE, which resulted in healthcare providers' illnesses and deaths. And so I think that very fundamentally, we really need to ramp up our ability to have these capabilities in place. And it requires an investment in resources.
And is that investment at the city level, the county, the state, the federal? Where is it?
It's all of the above.
Okay.
I think initially we were relying on a test at the CDC. And so I was on the phone as early as January, we were having travelers, our community members who live here, returning home from holidays abroad in China. And we were getting their information and tracking them and reaching out to them, making sure they were doing okay and isolating if they were sick. And I needed to get testing. And so I was on the phone with the CDC requesting testing, unable to get through, not getting a call back, calling back every 2 hours. And then when I finally spoke with an epidemiologist saying we didn't qualify, this individual who was sick didn't qualify for testing because it was so limited at the time. That's not a scenario that we want to be in the future. I hope that we can learn from that, really have the systems in place.
And do you think we are learning?
I certainly hope so. And that is one of our deepest fears, because we have seen this in public health before, where when there is an emergency, we are all on board with the investment that needs to happen. But maintaining that investment across time, people seem to have a short-term memory, and we're worried about people forgetting. It seems impossible right now in where we are that people would forget what we've just been through. But we are really concerned that in a few years' time, that investment and that commitment will go away.
So I want to talk about life and death, matters of life or death. You were being asked to make life or death decisions, not only about the virus, but about the livelihoods of your citizenry, right? Do you keep outdoor dining open or closed? What does that do to restaurants and all the people that work there? How do you make these decisions? I mean, How do you make these decisions? Because these were life or death decisions, not only virus related, but livelihood related.
So, you know, as physicians, we do train and do make decisions of that level of consequence frequently. But the difference here was trying to make those decisions on a much broader scale for 150,000 people, as opposed to just your patient who's in front of you. And yes, that's very difficult. I don't rely on just myself, right? We rely on the science. I have a team of scientists that we work with. I have colleagues, and we certainly have a very strong network of health officers across the state. And we rely on each other, both for emotional support in difficult times, but also for scientific professional support in this kind of decision-making. And as we can weigh the pros and cons for our community, but with each other. And that really is important for me. I think that, some of the key areas, as you mentioned, was considering each of these decisions are trade-offs. And as heavily as each person's life that was put at risk because of COVID weighed on us, it was also equally concerning to us, the economic impact and whether that would result in the loss of a home or really the learning loss that we saw students face from not being in school for a year. All of these are important health considerations. They directly impact people's health. And so we do, and I do, weigh all of these in making these decisions. For the outdoor dining decision, what happened was that because we are at a city level, because I had the support of our city manager and other city departments, we were able to work very closely. And that required an intense investment in resources in the sense that in order to keep outdoor dining open a little bit longer, we went out every night, especially Friday, Saturday, Sunday, to do inspections and ensure that our protocols, our public health protocols, are being followed. There were restaurants that we closed that first weekend because they weren't keeping people spaced enough, masks weren't being worn. We wanted to protect everyone's safety while protecting their economic well-being. And in order to do that, you had to couple both, you had to couple that with a lot of resources and intensity that at which really you can only do at a local level. I think a much larger county jurisdiction wouldn't be able to do that necessarily.
That's interesting. So being a city-driven health department, you had the ability to focus more and provide that opportunity for people to keep those restaurants open on an outdoor dining basis. Whereas if it had been a county decision, it would have been much more difficult to oversee.
We had to pull in not only health inspectors, but also code enforcement inspectors. We had the support of police late at night to go to restaurants and bars. And we needed all of that put together in order to support public health.
Now, you mentioned moments ago the topic of stress. I have to believe you haven't had many days off in the last year and a half.
No, although this past weekend, I did have a couple of days off that was really much needed. So it was really 15 to 16 months of really not having a day off. And it was...
Let me just think about that a second. 15 or 16 months without a single day off. Oh my gosh. How do you deal with that stress?
Well, there are a couple basic things. As a physician, you need to exercise. You need to eat. In the beginning, I didn't eat. I lost about 8 pounds in the first 3 months. I also lived and worked in the same house as my children, but I did not see them awake for 3 months. And I also did not really function as a parent for that 15 months. I really relied on my husband to play that role in our family. And so there were a lot of trade-offs, but at the same time, really staying focused on the fact that there wasn't anything, that the work that I was doing was for my family, it was for my community. And there wasn't really anything more important at that moment to be able to contribute and do. As I mentioned, having a community of colleagues was right. Extremely important, and having that support, having a team of we started with 100 staff, we've grown to about 140. And almost overnight, but having the support of all of my staff, plus our volunteers and the rest of our city, was really important because no one can do this alone.
This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf. More about guiding a major city through a pandemic with Ying Ying Go, the City of Pasadena's Director of Public Health. This is Stanford Pathfinders. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with Ying Go, the City of Pasadena's Director of Public Health, about guiding a major city through a pandemic. The beliefs about COVID, the beliefs about science, everything got politicized. Here we are in July of 2021. 70% of certain parts of this country, 75% are vaccinated. In other parts of this country, it's 30 or 35%. And if you look at it, it sort of breaks down on a political spectrum, right? So how do politics come into play in your job? I'm guessing you're supposed to be apolitical, but my guess is politics eke their way in. And how do you navigate that world?
It's quite challenging when, as a scientist, as a physician, we really just want the best outcomes for our community, and to be really undermined and many steps of throughout this process on from the national level on down is very hard. It's a tough pill to swallow, so to speak. But we have to work through it. And so we really try to stay committed to the truth and transparency, because public trust is so important. So much of what we do, even though I've issued over 40 legal orders, there's not a lot of enforcement that we want to do. We don't put people in jail because they violated their isolation or quarantine order. We want to instill trust in the public so that they will follow our directives, because they know that's what's best for them and for their community. And so we really try to create that relationship with the public and navigate through the politics by being the trusted voice. And where the politics got really hard during this pandemic for everyone in my kind of position was when the attacks became personal, and when the health officers and health officials' personal safety was at risk. And that happened over and over again. Many of my colleagues had to leave their jobs for that reason. And that, I think, is just unacceptable and really something that we need to address as a culture.
City and county health officers were receiving death threats.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel at risk?
I did, but I took some steps to protect myself, such as trying to remove my online presence entirely, which is unfortunate, because so much of what we need to do is to be present and messaging and communicating. So I can try to continue to do that in my professional role while removing myself personally. But I did feel, I think I'm lucky in this city that I did have the support of both the city government and elected officials for the most part. And so that really helped, where you saw some of the health officers getting attacked by their own elected officials. That was really counterproductive for the public.
All right, let's talk about vaccinations, because if there's one thing that city, county, state, and federal health officers are all in accord on, it's the need for everyone who can to get vaccinated. But at the same time, we've stalled, right? I mean, the country has stalled. Biden said by July 4th, our goal is to have 70% of all Americans vaccinated, and we fell short. There was a tremendous, sort of embrace of vaccines at first, and then it has just died. And I'm curious what you think. Why do you think so many Americans refuse to get vaccinated?
There are a lot of reasons, and we, in our vaccine outreach efforts, really try to work with every person where they are. And so we know there have been studies that show that there are some individuals who are in that group of people who aren't vaccinated yet, who aren't vaccinated for different reasons. So we try to address each barrier. If it's convenience, then we try to make it extremely convenient. With the information about the Delta variant, there's some individuals who were reluctant to get vaccinated before, who realized that they were more at greater risk than they thought. And so they became vaccinated after learning that the Delta variant is now the predominant variant out there. So I think it's, what we see is, as we stratify our vaccination data, we can see which groups are under vaccinated. And it's really our job as public health to reach those groups, to try and help protect them. There's no reason why Republicans should be more at risk for COVID. It's so unfortunate because the science is the same for Democrats or Republicans. There are certain racial groups. Our Latinx population here in Pasadena is vaccinated at half the rate of our white and Asian populations. That's not the way it should be. And so we are still actively working to address that.
So you mentioned the Delta variant. Let's talk a little bit about that. How should we think about it in July of 2021? And how do we stay safe, understanding its growing strength? I mean, the big push right now is if you've been vaccinated, Moderna or Pfizer, although it seems like Moderna may be a little stronger than Pfizer against it, you're okay. But if you haven't been vaccinated, you're at risk. And you're not only risk yourself, but you're risk of communicating, you're risk of infecting other people as well if you get it. So how should we think about the Delta variant right now?
Well, you've pretty much covered it because so far the data that we have about the Delta variant is exactly as you stated, get vaccinated, you will have significant protection. It's not 100% though, and it may be a little bit decreased. And so what is the concern for me, for example, in my family where I still have two young children who are unvaccinated, they're not eligible yet. I think it's smart to modify your behavior. I think that we shouldn't just relax completely. And so we're still wearing masks, particularly indoors. We're still limiting our social activities because they are at risk. And so I think I really urge people to consider what their own risk profile is and to modify their activities accordingly. There are always going to be new variants. Until we have herd immunity on this globe, which we are nowhere near attaining. We need to get our vaccine to all these other countries that are 5% or less fully vaccinated because it's really in our own interest.
As my mother used to say, from your mouth to you know whose ears. Ying, thank you so much for being on the show, but let me just say something else. On behalf of 235,000 Stanford alumni living in 151 countries around the globe, many of which are still fighting mightily against this virus, I want to thank you for what you do as a profession. You're doing very, very noble work, and we could not thank you more. So thank you so very much. Thank you for listening to Stanford Pathfinders on SiriusXM. Listen to this and other episodes anytime, on demand, with the SiriusXM app, or wherever you like to find your podcasts.